Commodity Week is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists. More information is at AgriGold.com or at 800-262-7333.
Can the wheat market continue to drive higher? Will corn follow? And what will happen with the ethanol industry? We'll ask all those questions and many more today on Commodity Week. Welcome to Commodity Week. I'm Todd Gleason. Kind of a special edition today. Just one guest will join us, Roy Huckabee of the Lynn Group in Chicago, Illinois.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Roy, thanks for being with us today. We appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here, Todd. It's Friday afternoon. Pretty dreary outside.
No,
be nice to stand in and talk for a while and not have to go out in the cold.
Well, we're going to get a little bit of time to talk this afternoon, but I think we've got a lot to talk about in the commodity markets, and maybe we probably should start with what happened Tuesday of this week. USDA, of course, releasing the ending stocks figures. Corn now at 1.797 billion bushels. That's down 100 million from the November estimate. Soybeans at just 185 million left in the bin when we get to next fall, down from 210. And wheat at 280 million. That one, too, was lower at 312 million. What did the marketplace do on Tuesday? And then how did the rest of the week work out as we looked at what was happening with the Fed and the rest of the world conditions?
Well, I think that the market took the crop report as a bit of a surprise, and it put corn into a bigger rally. It extended our gains pretty sharply. We had just broken out above last week the short-term trading ranges last week, and it extended the gains with some gap action. And it's actually got us back up towards the contract highs. The highest that March corn's traded was up around 437, and we traded those levels today.
So do you think we'll push on through those levels then?
Well, I think that it's certainly easy to talk about it. We had the Goldman Sachs forecast that came out midweek that talked about corn going to 530, and that's got everybody excited too. My problem with it is that, sure, I know that corn's going to be relatively tight and world stocks are tighter than U.S. stocks, but I think that we've never done this type of a rally without being cash-led. And the cash is really soft. Farmer is selling into the rally. He feels pretty good about these prices, and the market is going up in spite of that, and I think it's because of the speculative flurry that's taken place in our marketplace.
Well, have speculative flurries, and maybe we don't have enough history with this one just yet, but how have they taken place in the marketplace when we have a lot of outside money come in? And how might they get out? Do they get out? Is this different now that we have index funds that are really large out of New York and other places in Germany really playing in this marketplace?
Well, I think that the flow of money into commodities is seemingly never ending. But I think that the situation in the difference between index funds and hedge funds is pretty dramatic. But these guys have had big returns. I think that the Goldman Sachs index was up 27% last year, and they're projecting up 16% this year based on their prices. But I think that's kind of fueled the interest, but it's coming from everywhere. An inexhaustible supply of money to trade commodities. That's the way I see it.
Well, I have a question about that. Let's just take Goldman Sachs straight up. Is it a self-fulfilling prophecy when they simply move that much money that things move higher?
I think that there's something to that, but that's an accusation that I'll let somebody else levy.
Okay.
I think that when we come to year end, quarter end, month end, many of these index funds rebalance. And a market that's underperforming, just to get their percentages of investment back to normal, they got to buy the cheap markets. And that's the only time that we see them sell a market is when the market is overachieved. And to get their weightings back down to 27% in crude oil, they got to sell crude oil. or to get their corn ratings up to 3.5% of the portfolio, they got to buy corn. So when you hear the term rebalancing, that's what is being talked about. Now, we jumped over, we talked about corn coming out of the report. You want to talk about beans a little bit?
Sure.
The only changes in the government report was a 25 million bushel reduction in ending stocks based on a 5 million increase in crush and a 20 million increase in exports. The important number was buried in the products, which a lot of people don't look at, and that was a 400 million pound reduction in biodiesel usage.
Correct. That, well, there were two numbers, that one, and we'll take the other one up too, the 75 cent increase in the average cash price for farmers.
Well, that's a lagging indicator. I think we're already there.
Gotcha. So tell me about the 400 pounds.
Well, I think that the only people that have been making money in biodiesel as the soybean oil markets raced ahead away from the heating oil market has been the people that are able to do what's been labeled the splash and dash. Have you heard about that, Todd?
Sure.
For those that haven't, the splash and dash is where a biodiesel producer in the United States makes biodiesel and collects the dollar credit per gallon, puts a little bit of diesel, petroleum diesel, thus the splash, and takes it to Europe and imports it into Europe as a 99.9% biodiesel product and collects the European subsidy. And, of course, the U.S. has been taken to task on this, and both the U.S. and the EU need to close this loophole because that's not the intent of the program. And I think that's where you're seeing this cut in soy oil consumption, and I think it'll happen. What's kind of interesting to me is that the export demand for soy oil has gone up dramatically while the biodiesel demand has started to slow.
Well, that would be the domestic biodiesel demand, but probably wouldn't have much of an impact, I would think, on global biodiesel
demand. Well, I think that the world is having some of the same problems, and we'll talk about the EU in a minute with what they did with their acreage requirements. But I think that before we go there, you need to talk about the wheat S&Ds and what they did with wheat also.
And tell me about the supply and demand estimates there.
They took up exports by 25 million bushels. They took up the domestic mill grind by 5 million bushels, and that came primarily off of spring wheat, which is being imported directly by the northern mills from Canada, and we're seeing a heavier grind there, and they had to show that with an increased mill use. It bothers me because I find it very unusual in a year of very tight supplies that the domestic demand goes up. Almost every time we get this way, the domestic supply is rationed more easily than the world supply is. And I think that you're going to find that your exports in wheat stay a lot stronger than you think. The other interesting thing in the report was they took your seed use up another 2 million bushels to 88 million. And I'm going from memory, so you guys will have to stop me if I misspeak. But that's about a 9% increase in wheat for seed. And we went 81 million last year to 88 million this year. And that is a minimum of 5 million acre increase in wheat if you just take that and extrapolate it.
Mm-hmm. Well, does that not seem within the realm of possibility? Seems that there's an awful lot of wheat acres that went in the ground in places and by people that haven't done it before.
Yeah. I have an elevator in southeastern Iowa that at the convention last weekend told me one of his farmers had planted over 1,000 acres of wheat, had never, ever planted wheat before. And after he planted it, he came to the elevator and he says, "Are you going to make a market for this?" So I just don't think of soft red wheat being grown in Iowa. at all. So there happened to be a feed mill sitting with us at the table when this discussion came up, and he said, well, I'll give you a market for feed wheat, but you're not going to like the price. So it's going to be one of those years. Now, as this market has climbed in wheat, we've had two down days in July wheat, but this has been the bane for me, because that was the only really short position I had in the marketplace was new crop wheat. And a lot of hedges on my books. The farmer's been a very willing seller, not only for July 08, but for July 09 and even July 10. And the margin calls for these country elevators have just been eating them alive. Not only are the interest rates up because of the perception that the industrial base is having problems and maybe not as reliable a creditor as they would have been before, and rates have gone up, but also these rallies in flat price have just been phenomenal. If I look at the revenue stream from these higher prices, if you're ready to go there,
sure.
I think the rains across the Mid-South over the last 2 weeks, we've actually seen more soft red wheat acres planted in Kentucky and Tennessee where they can get away with it. They've still got some time for that wheat to sprout and tiller out before it goes dormant. Because with a flat price rally in wheat that's gone to, what, 830, 840, tonight it settles at 788 in Chicago, with a 70 bushel yield and a 60 or 70 under basis, that's a $510 revenue per acre.
Mm-hmm.
That's huge. Cost of about $150 to put wheat in the ground, that's a net revenue of $360 an acre.
You think those are, they put those on corn acres from last year? Or corn acre, what would have been corn acres for this year?
Corn acres in that part of the country tends to be irrigated. I think that this is a one place where you can bring in some acreage that's not all the time farmed.
Well, didn't we have an awful lot of acres from southern Illinois to Memphis that were
last year? Yeah. Even in the Louisiana and Mississippi and
corn,
Arkansas,
yeah.
Huge increases last year, and I think that this will cause these acres to flow back into wheat, and especially in those areas where you can double crop beans behind them. If I look at the same thing, beans in November tonight settle at 10.51, and on a farm that can grow 60 bushel beans, that's $606 revenue. $180 costings gives me a 426 type net revenue. Much better than the wheat revenue, but interesting, when you take the double crop, and I use 30 bushel yields on double crop, that might be a little strong, for a 305 revenue. I had the 305 revenue or net revenue of 125 to the 360 in soft red wheat, and I get a $485 in revenue per acre, and that's more than I can get growing any other crop. Unless I'm down there and can grow abnormally high corn yields. That area is notoriously, the corn yields aren't quite that good. But even if you compare that double crop acres to the middle of Illinois in your backyard,
mm-hmm.
with 200 bushel corn and 450 futures and a 25 under basis, that's $850 an acre revenue on good corn acres. Up till this point, I've said that nothing else could compete with that. That gives you about a 475 net revenue per acre. But with the rally in new crop wheat and the rally in new crop beans, this is the first time that the double crop scenario has competed with good corn acres. Now, in areas where you can't grow but 150 bushel corn, your net revenue is only about $260 or $270. Still good revenues, but not enough to compete with double crop, hard soft red wheat, and beans.
Well, do you think that this rebalances the portfolio enough to have much of an impact on acreage?
Well, nobody's planting anything tomorrow. Informa released some acreage numbers, the old Sparks people.
Mm-hmm.
They put out a 64.5 wheat number today, total. with 48.7 winter wheat, and I think they're way short. I'm using a 67 total wheat acres. I'm looking at an increase in 3 million in soft red wheat acres, and I'm looking at an increase of 1.5 million in hard red wheat acres and 500 in soft white wheat. And just this week, because of the rally in the Minneapolis market, I've had to add some durum and spring wheat as well. So I'm looking at an acreage number that is very, very strong compared to last year. I'm up 5.5 million acres.
Well, if you're up 5.5 million, you're up 5.5 million acres, and that's the second time we've heard that during this program for wheat. Are the losses out of corn, or are they out of soybeans? Or are we just planting more acres in total of all the crops?
We're going to find some acres. What I just described with the double crop revenues behind wheat, I'm looking at a 2.5 million acre increase in bean acres that comes off of double crop. 3 years ago, we planted 3.9 million double crop bean acres. Last year, we planted 5.8. This year, I'm looking at a number that's pushing 7.5 to 8. So we're finding some ways to get more from our farm ground. We'll lose some acres out of cotton again. We'll lose some acres out of rice, small. I think it's very hard to take acres out of the other feed grains, and I think it's very hard to take acreage out of forage crops because they just seem to be awfully strong priced, and I think if you start to lose alfalfa ground, your alfalfa and your hay prices just go up another notch.
Have you ever talked, this is kind of just a side note, but have you ever talked to the forage guys for very long, and they will tell you emphatically that hay and forages are the biggest revenue generator of all the commodities in the United States by a long shot, and pasture, I suppose, they include in that. But there are an awful lot of forage and pasture acres out there.
Well, let me share something with you out of California, Arizona, and that area, because in those areas, we have farmers that plant wheat, and as the wheat is growing, they chop it into a forage and blow it into a silo for the dairy market. Based on the amount of wheat I've seen sold by the California farmers, those dairies better be looking for some other source of forage.
Sounds like a good place for an ethanol production facility.
Don't take me there. Don't take me there.
Why not?
The ethanol industry has got real problems. I had at this convention I was talking about, we were there Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday here in Chicago with a country elevator convention of the National Grain and Feed. I had a friend from 15 years ago walked up and wrapped his arms around me and sat down beside me, and I hadn't seen Steve in so long, hadn't talked to him in a long time, and he laid a business card in front of me, and he's running an ethanol plant that's supposed to come up and operate next month. My heart just fell apart. I looked at him and I says, "Your timing sucks. This is a time when the ethanol profitability has just eroded so dramatically. I can make money this month in an ethanol plant, but when I get out into next month and the month after, those profits start to erode so rapidly. And by the time I get out in July, I don't see any way for an ethanol plant to hedge profitability at all. Matter of fact, the costs are so high that and the revenues deteriorated enough that I don't think that they can even cover variable cost."
Well, that would be those would be the conditions they operated on under this past summer, though, and then they came back and they're at what, 15 cents, I suppose, at this point.
Yeah, but corn's up even more. One of the problems is their cost structure has gone up, especially for a plant that's heavily borrowed. The cost of money and the subpar problem starts to sneak in here. Like I said, it did with my hedgers on some of the country elevators earlier. I think that their borrowing costs have shot up because of the nature of their loans being variable in rate. And if you were an ethanol plant that's been in operation for 5 years, you're doing pretty well. You got a big war chest. You've been making a lot of money. In the early part of last summer, you were probably still making a dollar and a half a bushel for every corn bushel that you ran through your plant. Incomes were almost obscene. But if you just went out and you bought the materials to build your plant, it cost you $2.20 a gallon to build it, and a 100-million-gallon plant, you got $220 million invested, or half of that invested and the rest borrowed, you're in trouble.
Well, does policy shift that if we put in something that requires a 15-billion-gallon RFS out of corn-based ethanol?
Well, I think it's all right to mandate it, if you're going to mandate it, you better do something to make the profitability issue. At this point, the only thing that's helped the profitability is the fact that ethanol prices have gotten so much cheaper than RBOB or unleaded gasoline,
mm-hmm.
That we've taken our blending up. And when I say blending up, I'm not talking about the mandated blending. I'm talking about the voluntary blending. And that has we've given about 12 cents a gallon cheaper gasoline on a 10% ethanol blend with the combination of a 50-cent discount to gasoline and a 50-cent blending credit, 51-cent blending credit.
Well, say they leave all the credits in place and they put the RFS and they double the RFS to 15.
Well, let's talk about what they did, because we have an energy bill passed in the House.
Correct.
And the Senate and the House are going to bless it. It's going to go to the White House. The fact that they stripped out the tax cuts for the petroleum industry, the White House is going to sign it.
Correct.
That takes your blending credit from 51 cents to 45 cents. Not a big cut. But that's going to pay for some of the increases for cellulosic ethanol. Cellulosic ethanol stays at 51 cents for the blender's credit. We get a 50-cent subsidy for the cellulosic producer, and most of them are small plants, so they get a 10-cent credit for being a small plant. So we're going to take the credits for ethanol made from cellulosic material from 46 cents for corn to $1.11 for cellulosic. Now, interesting, what do you think is the biggest supply of cellulosic material? What are we all talking about? Switchgrass, corn cobs, corn fodder?
Probably straw.
Well, there's a closer supply. When we take a bushel of corn in and make ethanol, out of that comes 18 pounds of distiller's grains.
Correct, yeah. Yes.
That's all cellulosic, according to the ethanol industry. They're trying their darndest to find a way to take that DDG and run it back through the plant and make ethanol out of it again.
Well, if they can figure that, I mean, if you're at a dry grind plant and you put on a process up front, you can take it out up front and then run that fiber through a separate side,
yes,
by itself.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose if it has to be a different process, it would pay you then to put on the upfront process. And this,
well, what you're describing is a fractionation plant where,
yeah,
they take the heart of the germ of the corn out before they process it.
Yes,
that plant is making a very high protein corn gluten feed, which is in extremely high demand in Asia. Is none of that going to be run back through the plant? It's being loaded in containers.
Well, when you fractionate it, you get both, though.
Well,
you get the germ.
I hear you. Yeah, you get the germ with a real high protein meal, and what you're left is with the DDG, a smaller share of the DDG.
Yeah, the fiber.
But it is of a lesser quality. It doesn't have nearly as much oil or nearly as much energy in it as the current DDG varieties. We're talking about a DDG that's running 27, 28, 29% protein.
So you think it's more effective to take the back end out of the current plant and run it back through,
right,
a process?
Mm-hmm.
Is anybody? I haven't seen research on that. Is somebody doing it?
first time I heard about it was from USDA guys last weekend. I had to listen to them say it four or five times before I really understood what they were talking about. Because, quite honestly, DDG values have been very strong, as the cattle and dairy industry find that the DDGs are really help extend their feed conversions.
Especially when they're short of straw or short of hay like they are this year, it helps a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Well, we're down to the end of our time. Let me go through some numbers real quick, because we always give them through Commodity Week. And then maybe you can give us a final word. How about that?
Super.
Okay. December wheat this week, a high of 950.5. Their low at 885.5. A settlement price 36.5 cents higher at 939. July settled at 788. It was off 20. Remember, our highs and low reflect all of the trade throughout the week, not just the day trade, but of the overnight and the e-trade at the Chicago Board of Trade and the CME Group. December futures, 422 on the high for the corn, low at 398.25, settlement price up 20.5 at 420. December 08 at 450.5, up 15.5. Jan beans at 1164.5 for the high, the low at $11.15, settlement price up 37.25 for the January's at 11.57. The NOVE contract at 10.51.25 for the new crop harvest month, down 2.25. December live cattle from the CME Group, 94.77.5 on the high, the low at 91.95. Their settlement price at 92.60, $1.42.5 lower. The January's at 103.80. We're down, I don't have that number in front of me at the moment. December lean hogs at 55.90, the high, the low at $55. Settlement price for the December lean hogs at 55.10. We're down 37.5 cents. Roy Huckabee, it's been a real pleasure having you on the program today. You have a final word for us?
Well, it's very hard to hold these rallies together into the Christmas holidays, and it would be typical for us to fail. And there's the old saying that the bull gets his turkey for Thanksgiving and the bear gets his for Christmas, and I think that could very well happen this year. But these markets have a lot of upside momentum, and I think the farm community needs to be aware of it. There's a chance that corn trades to $5. There's a chance that beans trade to $12.50 and maybe higher. The meal market's been the leader. I think that over the coming week you're going to find it. That soybean oil comes back into more favor. The Asian trade's going to be after it. And wheat, we'll run out of wheat sometime this spring, and we don't know when. But I think that the wheat market could do to 1090 to 1125 very easy. The only thing is I don't think new crop wheat warrants prices these high.
Our guest this week on Commodity Week has been Roy Huckabee of the Lynn Group in Chicago, Illinois. Our thanks to him. A quick reminder that you can hear this programming again if you'd like on our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. I'm Todd Gleason. You have a good week.
Commodity Week is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists. More information is at agrigold.com or at 800-262-7333.